Right now, as you're listening to this, you're likely carrying a device in your pocket, or maybe you're even holding it.
Most likely, yeah.
And this device instantly connects you to over 4 billion human beings. I mean, you can beam your face into the living room of someone on the exact opposite side of the planet.
Right, in real time. Yeah.
Exactly. With like less friction than it took our ancestors to borrow a cup of sugar from a neighbor.
It's incredible engineering.
It is. Yet, statistically speaking, there is a massive chance that you, the listener, are currently experiencing a state of social isolation so profound that your brain is processing it using the exact same neural hardware it uses to process touching a hot stove.
It's the ultimate cinematic paradox of our era, really,
Yeah.
because we've successfully collapsed geographic distance to absolute zero. The infrastructure is a marvel, but the psychological reality, we are just starving for emotional resonance. We're living in this chronic global state of being alone together.
Alone together. That phrase from the literature is so haunting. It really captures the vibe of this issue.
It perfectly distills it.
To put a visual to what this actually feels like for you, the listener, think about being stranded in the middle of the ocean. You're dying of thirst. There's fluid everywhere you look,
Yeah,
right?
water in every direction.
It's crashing over the bow of your lifeboat. It's filling your vision. You're practically drowning in it. But because it's salt water, it is fundamentally incapable of hydrating your cells.
Right. It actually does the opposite.
Exactly. Drinking it will dehydrate you faster. It accelerates the crisis. And that is what our modern digital landscape feels like for the human nervous system.
That's a brutal analogy, but it's incredibly accurate.
We're swimming in this endless sea of texts, notifications, algorithmic feeds, and likes, but our bodies are parched for actual hydrating human connection.
Which is why we can't afford to frame loneliness the way we historically have in pop culture.
How do you mean?
Well, culturally, we tend to dismiss it, right?
Yeah.
We treat it as this fleeting emotional state, like, oh, you're having a bad afternoon, or it's just a temporary psychological slump.
Yeah, just join a club or go to a party, you know? Shake it off.
Exactly. But the stack of sources we're analyzing today, which, by the way, crosses over medical epidemiology, sociology, neurobiology, and even these really deep philosophical texts like Fractal the Trilogy and the Oracle 2.0.
Huge stack of material today.
It is. And it makes an unequivocal demand of us. We have to treat this as an existential threshold. It's a fundamental crisis of belonging that registers not as sadness, but as literal tissue-damaging physical pain.
And the goal for our time together today isn't just to sit around and admire the problem.
No, not at all.
Because it's very easy, almost a cliche at this point, to just sit back and lament how disconnected the modern world is. Our mission for this deep dive is to dissect the why.
Right. Why does it physically hurt?
Yes. Why have we engineered a society that actively starves us? And ultimately, we're going to unpack the structural solution proposed by the sources, which they call the belonging architecture.
I think to start answering the why, we really have to look past the subjective feeling of being lonely and examine the cold, hard, objective data.
The epidemiology.
Exactly. Because if we feel this crisis in our bones, we need to know what it's actually doing to our physical bodies on a cellular level. This is where the narrative shifts from a psychological inconvenience to a massive public health emergency.
I remember reading the meta-analytic reviews in the source material, and these encompass hundreds of thousands of individuals over long longitudinal periods. The numbers are so severe, they almost sound like typos.
They really do.
Lacking social connection increases your likelihood of early mortality by 29 to 32%.
Oh, that's sinking.
But percentages can feel abstract. Julianne Holt Lundstedt's research quantified this in a way that is just utterly visceral. Her data demonstrates that chronic loneliness and social isolation contribute to earlier death to a magnitude comparable with smoking up to 15 cigarettes a day.
15 a day. It eclipses the mortality risks of conditions we spend billions of dollars fighting. It's deadlier than obesity. It's deadlier than physical inactivity. It's deadlier than breathing polluted air. The data shows an approximately 30% increased risk of developing coronary artery disease and experiencing a major stroke.
Oh, wow.
The body is essentially consuming itself under the weight of the isolation.
15 cigarettes a day. I really want you, the listener, to hold on to that image. Because if you had a close friend or a family member who was chain smoking nearly a pack a day, you'd intervene.
Absolutely, you'd say something.
You would sit them down, express deep concern for their cardiovascular health, their lungs, their future. But we routinely let ourselves and the people we love slip into weeks or even months of total social isolation.
And we sanitize it too.
We completely do. We call it like being busy with work or needing some space or just being in a hermit phase right now.
Right, we give it socially acceptable branding. But the autonomic nervous system does not care about our branding.
It really doesn't.
The physiological toll is exacted continuously, regardless of the excuse. Blood pressure remains elevated. Inflammation markers spike. And to truly grasp the mechanism driving this, the literature points us toward animal models.
Right. What happens when they isolate mammalian subjects?
Well, their internal architecture radically alters. They exhibit incredibly high adrenals to body weight ratios.
Meaning the adrenal glands are physically enlarging because the body is just flooded with stress hormones, right? It's pumping out cortisol as if it's under constant physical attack.
Yes. It is the classic biomarker of chronic, inescapable stress. But the destruction extends into the brain's capacity to heal and grow. Socially isolated subjects demonstrate significantly lower levels of BDNF across critical brain regions.
Let's break down BDNF for a second, because this is where the cognitive impacts really start to make sense.
No.
Brain-derived neurotrophic factor. I've always thought of it as like fertilizer for the brain.
That's a highly accurate analogy.
It's the protein that drives neuroplasticity, allowing our brains to adapt, form new synapses, lay down new memories.
Exactly. BDNF is what keeps the brain structurally resilient. It operates heavily in the frontal cortex, the hippocampus, the hypothalamus, the midbrain.
Which are the regions responsible for executive function, spatial memory, and emotional regulation.
Right. So when loneliness suppresses BDNF production, you are literally degrading the brain's physical capacity to adapt to stress. You lose the ability to regulate intense emotions or ward off depressive states.
The brain becomes rigid.
Completely rigid.
Which totally explains a very specific subjective experience. Like, think about your own life. Maybe during a period where you were working remotely, ordering delivery, just interacting with screens for days on end with minimal genuine human contact.
You start to feel this thick cognitive fog.
Yes. You become emotionally brittle. A minor annoyance, like a dropped Wi-Fi signal or a delayed package, suddenly makes you want to snap.
Right. That subjective feeling of rigidity maps directly onto this objective drop in BDNF. Your brain is starving for the structural fertilizer it needs to remain flexible.
And this physiological degradation isn't distributed evenly, is it? The sources break this down fascinatingly. We traditionally associate severe loneliness with the elderly, and older adults certainly face a profound crisis.
They do. But it's a specific variant that techs term digital isolation.
Right, because for older adults, the physical isolation is often compounded by a lack of technological access or literacy. They might physically live alone, but then they're also locked out of the digital spaces where modern society has migrated.
Exactly. They struggle with telehealth platforms or the constantly shifting UI of video calling apps they need just to see their families. They are essentially marooned on an analog island in a digital ocean.
Wow, yeah. And then you move to working age adults who are dealing with a totally different set of pressures. Workplace atomization, remote labor silos, and what sociologists term liquid modern bonds.
This highly transient, non-committal approach to relationships.
But the demographic that is flashing the absolute brightest red on the epidemiological dashboard is adolescents and young adults, the digital natives.
This is where the data gets incredibly alarming.
And this is actually where I struggle to reconcile the data with what I see in the real world, because the sources indicate that up to 40% of individuals aged 16 to 24 report persistent daily feelings of loneliness.
Almost half of an entire generation.
Almost half. But if you observe a 19-year-old today, they appear hyper-connected. They're constantly in group chats. They're on headsets gaming with friends across the country for hours every night. They're maintaining Snapchat streaks.
Right.
How is it neurologically possible for nearly half of them to feel persistently lonely when their attention is technically occupied by peers 24/7?
This is the crux of the modern illusion, really. And it requires us to separate actual intimacy from what the sources term digital loneliness.
Okay, unpack that.
Well, being a highly visible node in a digital network does not satisfy the mammalian requirement for being known. Social media architectures and constant asynchronous messaging, they just create a simulation of friendship.
A simulation.
Yeah. They provide a frictionless, shallow dopamine fix, a like, a view, a streak. But this simulation fundamentally denies the human psychological apparatus what it evolved to require, meaning depth, physical proximity, and relational safety.
It's the saltwater analogy playing out in real time. The older demographics are isolated because they're locked out of the water entirely, but the youth are isolated because they're drowning in it.
That's exactly it.
They're drinking gallons of semantic data exchange every single day, but they're dying of thirst for emotional resonance. And to the brain, it doesn't matter if the isolation is a physical empty room or a crowded digital feed. The physiological cascade is identical.
Which forces us to ask a much deeper mechanical question. If the health consequences of loneliness are as severe as chain smoking, the body must be processing it through a highly aggressive, deeply ingrained biological mechanism.
It isn't just a vague feeling of sorrow.
Right. How exactly does the brain register a missed text, a ghosted date, or the feeling of being fundamentally misunderstood by your peers?
To answer that, we have to transition from epidemiology into the neurobiology of social pain. And this requires a quick look at evolutionary biology. Humans are born completely altricial, meaning entirely helpless and dependent.
A human infant cannot survive on its own. It requires intensive, long-term caregiving and ultimately integration into a larger tribe.
Because survival depended absolutely on inclusion within the group, evolution had to ensure that we stayed connected. But evolution is efficient. Instead of building an entirely new neural system from scratch to manage social attachment, the mammalian brain piggybacked on a system that was already fully operational.
And impossible to ignore.
Right, the physical pain system. Because thousands of years ago, being separated from the tribe didn't just mean you were sad or bored. It meant you were going to freeze, starve, or be eaten by a predator.
It meant literal imminent death.
So the brain needed an alarm system that would force you to seek out the group with the exact same urgency that you would pull your hand away from a fire.
To prove this shared hardware, the sources highlight pioneering fMRI studies led by Naomi Eisenberger at UCLA. They utilized a virtual paradigm called Cyberball, and it remains one of the most elegant demonstrations of social pain in the literature.
The setup for this is so fascinating. They put participants inside an fMRI scanner so they could monitor their real-time blood flow and brain activity. The participant looks at a screen inside the scanner and plays a simple virtual ball-tossing game with two other avatars.
And the researchers tell the participant that these two avatars are controlled by two other real people in different rooms.
But those other people don't exist. The avatars are simply a computer script. For the first few minutes, the script is equitable. The avatars toss the ball to the participant. The participant tosses it back. Everyone is included.
But then the script executes its primary function. It actively excludes the participant. The two avatars begin throwing the ball only to each other, completely ignoring the human in the scanner.
It sounds almost trivial, right? It's the digital equivalent of being picked last in elementary school gym class or watching your coworkers go out to lunch without inviting you.
But what the fMRI revealed is anything but trivial. When the participant was excluded by these crude digital avatars, specific regions of their brain flared with activity. Specifically, the dorsal anterior cingulate cortex, the DACC, and the anterior insula.
And the significance of those two regions cannot be overstated.
No, it can't.
Because the DACC and the anterior insula are the exact neural regions that process the effective distressing component of physical pain. They are what tell your brain, this physical sensation is terrible and we need it to stop immediately.
So, to the brain's internal processing center, being left out of a game of catch by a computer program registers on the exact same alarm system as breaking your tibia or undergoing surgery.
Wow.
The physical-social pain overlap isn't a metaphor, it is an undeniable biological reality.
The sources further validate this by examining the genetic layer of the phenomenon, specifically the OPRM1 gene. This is the mu opioid receptor gene, which regulates the body's internal opioid system, our most potent natural painkillers.
What the researchers discovered here is just staggering. Variations in this specific gene dictate an individual's sensitivity to physical painkillers, like morphine. But it also dictates their sensitivity to social rejection.
People with a specific minor allele variation are more sensitive to physical pain. They require more medication to soothe an injury. And those exact same individuals show significantly more distress in their DACC when they are subjected to social exclusion.
The chemical hardware managing the pain is completely shared.
That dramatically alters the paradigm of how we view hurt feelings. In our culture, hurt feelings are often treated as subjective, floaty emotional states. We tell people to grow thicker skin or just get over it.
Right, but this data proves they aren't just feelings. They are a neurological alarm system screaming that your biological survival is at risk.
But the literature highlights a crucial divergence between physical pain and social pain, specifically regarding how we relive the trauma. And I think this is where the true devastation of chronic loneliness lies.
Absolutely.
Let's use an analogy. Imagine you broke your arm 5 years ago. It was an agonizing experience at the time. But if you sit in your chair right now and vividly remember breaking your arm doesn't start throbbing with intense pain today.
It doesn't, because reliving physical pain primarily activates the sensory discriminative pain system, specifically the somatosensory cortex. You can recall the factual event, you can remember that it hurt, but your brain does not subject you to re-experiencing the acute, distressing agony in the present moment.
But social pain operates under completely different rules.
Yeah.
If you sit in that same chair and vividly remember a brutal, humiliating breakup or a moment you were deeply betrayed by someone you trusted or a time you were ostracized by a friend group years ago, your chest physically tightens.
Your stomach drops.
Your heart rate accelerates right now in the present moment. You feel the pain all over again.
That phenomenon occurs because reliving social pain reactivates the DACC and the anterior insula. It physically turns the alarm bell right back on.
Wow.
The source text utilizes a deeply poignant historical quote that summarizes this biological quirk perfectly. It says, "Moral and social wounds have the peculiarity of remaining fresh and open in the heart, always ready to bleed when touched."
Always ready to bleed when touched. It's incredibly poetic, but it's describing a brutal neurological trap.
And it perfectly explains why chronic loneliness functions as a state of perpetual relived neurological trauma. When an individual is isolated, the brain's default mode network, the DMN, actually ramps up its activity.
The DMN is responsible for self-referential thought and mind wandering, right?
Exactly. In lonely individuals, it drives self-focused rumination. It forces the person to obsess over their isolation, causing them to hyperanalyze past rejections and interpret even neutral modern social cues negatively. It keeps the social wound constantly fresh and bleeding.
But if our brains are hardwired to view this isolation as a literal death sentence, and that alarm is constantly ringing in the DACC, how does the rest of the body actually cope with it?
That's the big question.
Because the brain is locked inside the skull. But the effects of loneliness, the coronary artery disease, the strokes, the inflammation, happen everywhere else. How does the alarm bell travel from the brain down into the cardiovascular system?
To track that alarm, we have to look at the body's autonomic nervous system. The distress doesn't stay confined to the skull. It echoes throughout the entire body, primarily mediated by the vagus nerve. And the framework our sources use to explain this is Dr. Stephen Porges' polyvagal theory.
Polyvagal theory is one of those concepts that, once you understand it, acts like a secret decoder ring for all human behavior. It completely changes how you view yourself and the people around you.
It truly is foundational. Polyvagal theory explains how our autonomic nervous system continuously and automatically organizes our physiological state in response to the environment. It operates through a subconscious process that Porges termed neuroception.
Neuroception. I want to highlight that this is distinct from perception. Perception is conscious and cognitive. Perception is looking at a room and thinking, I see a chair, I see a window, I see my friend. Neuroception happens entirely beneath the level of conscious thought.
Exactly. It is your neural circuits constantly, relentlessly scanning the environment to answer one primal question. Am I safe? Am I in danger? Or is my life currently threatened?
Right.
Based on the subconscious answer to that question, the nervous system shifts the entire body into one of three hierarchical states.
Let's walk through these three states, starting from the top, where we all ideally want to be.
The first state is the ventral vagal state. This is the state of safety, social engagement, and connection. It's mediated by the newer, myelinated pathways of the vagus nerve. When your neuroception detects a safe environment and safe people, you enter this state.
Well, what does that feel like?
It promotes calm, emotional accessibility, and physical restoration. Your heart rate is regulated dynamically, your breathing is deep and steady, and your immune system functions optimally.
There is a detail about the ventral vagal state in the sources that absolutely blew my mind regarding the physical changes in the body. It involves the middle ear muscles.
Oh, it is one of the most incredible biological adaptations we have. When we are in the ventral vagal state, when we feel truly safe, the tiny muscles in our middle ear literally physically tighten.
That's so wild.
Right. They alter their tension so that we can prioritize and tune in to the specific frequency of human vocal ranges while simultaneously filtering out low-frequency background noise. Our bodies physically reconfigure their sensory intake to prioritize human connection.
I just love that so much. Our biology literally leans in to listen to each other when we feel safe. But, of course, the environment isn't always safe. What happens when neuroception detects a threat?
When danger is detected, the system drops down into the second state, the sympathetic state, which is mobilization. This is the classic fight-or-flight response. The ventral vagal brake is released. Cortisol and adrenaline flood the system.
Your heart rate elevates dramatically.
Blood is shunted away from digestive organs and into your limbs, and your body prepares to aggressively defend itself or run for its life.
And what if the threat is so overwhelming or so chronic that you realize you can't fight it and you can't outrun it?
Then the nervous system drops into the oldest evolutionary defense mechanism we have, shared with ancient reptiles, the third state, the dorsal vagal state.
Immobilization.
Exactly. It is an extreme threat response that leads to biological shutdown, behavioral collapse, dissociation, and extreme metabolic conservation. It is the physiological equivalent of a mouse playing dead in the jaws of a cat. You feel numb, disconnected, and entirely depleted of energy.
So mapping loneliness onto this framework is incredibly revealing. Chronic loneliness sends a persistent, unchanging message of danger and isolation to the brain. Therefore, it locks the body out of the ventral vagal state and traps it in either the sympathetic fight or flight state or the dorsal vagal shutdown state. As we established earlier, a lonely person doesn't just feel unhappy, they feel biologically unsafe. Their nervous system is functioning as if a predator is constantly circling their home 24 hours a day.
Which perfectly explains the 15 cigarettes a day mortality metric. You cannot run your engine in the red zone of sympathetic arousal or the complete shutdown of dorsal vagal collapse for years without catastrophic wear and tear on your cardiovascular and immune systems.
Right.
So the imperative question becomes, how do we get out of the threat state? What is a biological cure?
How do we get back to the ventral vagal state of safety?
The answer lies in a biological process called co-regulation. Our nervous systems, because of our evolutionary history as tribal mammals, are not designed to self-regulate entirely on their own, especially in states of high distress.
We need help.
We do. Co-regulation is the process where two nervous systems interact and soothe each other in real time. When you interact with someone you fundamentally trust, and they offer a soft, melodic tone of voice, an empathic gaze, a relaxed facial expression, and a calming posture. Those are all implicit signals of safety.
And your nervous system reads their nervous system, realizes there's no threat present, and finally allows your body to release the physiological brake and relax.
Exactly.
I think every single person listening can intuitively relate to this. Like, have you ever had a moment of intense anxiety? Maybe you're waiting on a medical test result, or you had a massive failure at work. Your heart is racing. Your thoughts are spiraling.
You've all been there.
And then a trusted friend or your partner walks into the room, and you just hear the specific familiar cadence of their voice. Before you even logically process the words they're saying, your shoulders physically drop, your chest expands, you take your first deep breath in hours.
That is the ventral vagal state activating through co-regulation. Your nervous system uses their nervous system as a ladder to climb out of the threat state.
It is the nervous system's shortcut to safety. But understanding co-regulation also explains precisely why our hyperconnected digital world is failing us so profoundly. Texting fundamentally lacks vocal prosody, the tone, rhythm, and melody of the voice.
An emoji or an avatar does not have a micro-expression.
Right. Co-regulation requires continuous subtle physical cues that digital interfaces deliberately strip away in the name of efficiency.
They sanitize the interaction.
Now, I want to push back on this a little bit, bringing in a very common modern dilemma. Because I hear people make an argument all the time, and I've felt it myself. People say, you know, when I'm deeply anxious or feeling alone in my apartment, I put on my favorite YouTuber, or I listen to a familiar podcast.
Yeah.
The host's voice is soothing, it's familiar, and it demonstrably calms my anxiety down. So if co-regulation is the biological cure, why can't we achieve it through these parasocial relationships? Why does it strictly need to be a two-way street?
It's an excellent question. It highlights the nuance of the nervous system. Listening to a familiar, calm voice on a screen or through headphones can certainly provide a baseline level of soothing. It can perhaps take the edge off a sympathetic spike and provide a temporary sense of comfort.
But
from a polyvagal perspective, it is fundamentally incomplete. True co-regulation is a dynamic, reciprocal feedback loop. Your nervous system needs to send out a distress signal, and then it needs to see its own safety and its own emotion mirrored back by another living organism reacting to you in real time.
I see.
A pre-recorded video cannot react to the subtle shift in your breathing. It cannot soften its gaze when you show a micro expression of fear. Without that real-time reciprocal feedback loop, the nervous system remains partially guarded. It knows, subconsciously, that it's still ultimately alone in the room.
So if our biology so desperately demands face-to-face, uninterrupted, dynamic co-regulation just to maintain our physical health, why have we built a society that actively prevents it?
It's the great structural contradiction.
Why is every incentive structure designed to keep us staring at screens instead of each other? That tension brings us to the sociology of our current era, with a source text referred to as liquid modernity.
To understand the structural origins of our loneliness, we must examine the work of sociologist Zygmunt Bauman. He coined the term liquid modernity to describe the transition from the solid social structures of the past to the fluid, transient arrangements of the present.
Solid versus liquid.
Yes. In the past, society was solid. You likely lived in a specific geographic neighborhood for decades. You had a lifelong career at a single company. You belonged to established community or religious organizations. And relationships and marriages were largely fixed and difficult to dissolve.
But in the late-stage modern era, those solid structures have melted.
Exactly. Everything has become fluid, endlessly flexible, and instantly renegotiable.
Let's unpack how this concept of liquid modernity applies directly to our relationships. Bauman actually wrote a specific book on this called Liquid Love, which details the commodification of human intimacy.
In Liquid Love, Bauman argues that the modern individual is subjected to an intense, pervasive, neoliberal pressure to always keep their options open. Commitment is viewed not as a sanctuary, but as a trap that limits future optimization.
We have essentially transformed courtship and even friendship into a commodified consumer game.
Dating apps are the ultimate literal expression of liquid love. You are presented with a virtually infinite catalog of human beings, and you are encouraged to swipe through them with the exact same mindset you use to shop for shoes online.
And it creates relational phenomena that we now just accept as entirely normal, like ghosting or situationships.
A situationship is a brilliant example of liquid modernity. It is a connection defined precisely by its lack of definition.
Right.
It allows the individual to experience a simulation of intimacy while retaining the ability to untie the bond at a moment's notice with zero friction or social consequence. We are conditioned to treat human beings as consumable experiences to be discarded when they no longer perfectly serve our immediate emotional needs, rather than as sacred commitments that require work to maintain.
It reminds me of how people treat streaming services. Think about how you pick a movie nowadays. You sit down on the couch, you open the app, and instead of just watching a movie, you spend 45 minutes endlessly scrolling through titles, watching trailers, looking for the absolute perfect option to maximize your time.
And because there are thousands of options, the paradox of choice paralyzes you.
Yes. You never actually commit to watching anything, and you just end up turning off the TV and going to sleep feeling empty, overwhelmed, and vaguely dissatisfied. We are applying that exact same algorithmic consumer behavior to human beings.
That analogy captures the exhaustion perfectly. And because we are constantly tying and untying these bonds so shallowly, always looking for the next upgrade, we never reach the relational depth required to actually engage that ventral vagal state of biological safety.
Right, the biology and the sociology just collide.
The sociologist Sherry Turkle expands on this structural deficit by examining how our attention itself has been fragmented. She uses a term called continuous partial attention.
Continuous partial attention. Meaning, we are never fully focused on anything or anyone at any given time. We're always hedging our bets.
Yes. Turkle points out that even when we are physically co-located with someone, we are often absent present. You are sitting at the dinner table with a friend, but your cognitive awareness is partially absorbed in the device sitting face up next to your plate.
And as we just discussed with polyvagal theory and co-regulation, breaking eye contact to check a notification literally starves the other person's nervous system of the safety signal that requires.
Exactly.
I think this is a huge realization. Digital interruptions aren't just rude from a manners perspective. They are biologically violent. Every time you glance at your Apple Watch while someone is speaking to you, you are severing the physiological feedback loop of co-regulation in real time. You are dropping them out of ventral vagal safety.
Furthermore, this constant digital splitting leads to what Turkle calls distributed presence. We exist across multiple platforms simultaneously. You are a highly polished professional version of yourself on LinkedIn, an aesthetically curated version on Instagram, a hyper-reactive version on X, and a different version in your private text threads.
This fragments the core self, leading to profound identity diffusion.
Which perfectly dovetails with Irving Goffman's sociological concept of the performative self. We spend vast amounts of energy curating these idealized digital masks to broadcast to the world.
But it creates a brutal, agonizing paradox. You become highly visible, but completely unknown. You might have an Instagram story seen by 3,000 people. You are perceived. But because you are broadcasting a curated mask, you remain fundamentally entirely unknown in your raw, messy vulnerability.
Which is incredibly, deeply exhausting. The pervasive fatigue that so many people feel today isn't just physical tiredness from a lack of sleep. It is the structural exhaustion of managing multiple digital avatars, constantly calculating how you're being perceived, knowing that none of those avatars reflect your unedited reality.
Wow.
And this structural loneliness extends even beyond interpersonal relationships. Modernity has caused a catastrophic loss of broader anchors. We have lost spatial anchors like deep, intergenerational ties to a physical neighborhood or landscape.
And temporal anchors too, right?
Yes. We've lost the psychological feeling of being embedded in a long continuum of ancestors and descendants, which historically provided a sense of meaning that transcended the individual ego.
Okay, I have to step in here and offer some serious pushback. Because I can hear a listener absorbing all this sociology from Bauman and Turkle and thinking, wait a minute, isn't liquid modernity just a cynical academic term for freedom?
That's a fair question.
In the past, those solid structures they are romanticizing meant people were hopelessly trapped. Women were trapped in abusive marriages because divorce was a social taboo. People were stifled by oppressive small-town gossip and rigid religious hierarchies. Isn't having the option to untie bonds easily and having the freedom to leave a bad situation a massive, hard-won victory for human rights?
That is a critical point of friction, and it is a very necessary debate. The sources do not deny that freedom of choice and the dismantling of oppressive hierarchies is deeply valuable. The argument being made is not a regressive plea to return to rigid, patriarchal, or stifling structures.
So what is the argument?
The argument focuses on the extreme trajectory of this transition. We have swung the pendulum so far into hyper-individualism that we have discarded the concept of structural anchors altogether. The texts argue that freedom without any anchoring community or shared meaning doesn't actually feel like liberation. It feels like floating in a terrifying void.
We traded suffocating structures for agoraphobic atomization.
Exactly. We successfully gained the freedom to leave any relationship at any time, but in the process, we lost the framework and the stamina required to stay, endure friction, and build deep, resilient trust.
That distinction makes a lot of sense. We gained the exit door, but we forgot how to furnish the house. So sociology shows us how our structural environment has melted into this chaotic liquid state. And neuroscience shows us why that liquid state is setting off literal biological alarms in our bodies.
But the specific sources we're exploring today insist that we cannot stop there.
To truly understand why this liquid, disconnected world hurts so much, we have to go one layer deeper. We have to look at the spiritual and philosophical texts provided in our stack, specifically Fractal the Trilogy and its companion, the Oracle 2.0.
This is where the synthesis of all our disparate sources reaches its absolute peak. Because from the perspective of these philosophical texts, the pain in the DACC, the dorsal vagal shutdown, the exhaustion of liquid mundane, all of these are merely the biological and sociological echoes of a much deeper foundational spiritual forgetting.
The text identifies a core existential error that is driving the entire loneliness epidemic. They call it the illusion of separation.
The illusion of separation is the egoic, deeply conditioned belief that we are discrete, atomized units fighting for survival in an indifferent mechanical universe. It is the belief that you fundamentally end at your skin and everything outside of your skin is definitively other.
It is the ultimate expression of hyper-individualism.
But the philosophical frameworks presented here, drawing heavily on deep ecology, quantum mechanics, and non-dual Eastern philosophies, argue that this assumption is fundamentally structurally false.
To articulate this, the text heavily references the Zen master Thich Nhat Hanh and his concept of interbeing, or in Sanskrit, Pratityasamutpada.
Interbeing is the profound realization of absolute interdependence. Thich Nhat Hanh famously articulated that the Buddhist concept of emptiness doesn't mean nothingness or a dark void. It means that we are empty of a separate, independent self.
There is a spatial dimension to this, right?
Yes, meaning that everything currently existing only exists because everything else exists in relation to it. The flower cannot exist without the soil, the rain, the sun, and the pollinator.
And there's a temporal dimension representing the impermanence of all forms. The core truth of interbeing is that there is simply no I without the we. The boundary of the skin is a functional illusion.
The Oracle 2.0 explains this interconnectedness using the holographic universe theory. The quote that completely stuck with me is...
Oh, wait, I have it written down here. The universe does not repeat, it reflects.
Yes, which completely upends our standard view of reality. The separation of individuals is described in the text as a useful illusion. It is an illusion that universal consciousness temporarily wears like a garment in order to experience itself from multiple perspectives through the friction of contrast.
But the tragedy of the modern era is that we have forgotten it's an illusion. We have calcified those temporary boundaries into permanent prisons of isolation.
Yes.
To really ground this holographic concept for the listener, I want to offer an analogy about how holograms actually work, because it's fundamentally different from traditional photography. If you have a normal physical photograph of an apple and you rip that photograph in half, you lose half the data. You have a broken picture.
Right.
If you rip it again, you only have a quarter of the apple. But a holographic plate doesn't store information that way. If you drop a holographic plate and it shatters into 100 tiny shards on the floor, if you pick up any single tiny shard and shine a laser through it, that microscopic shard will still project the entire complete three-dimensional image of the apple.
The whole is contained in every single part.
Yes. That mechanism is exactly what the Oracle 2.0 is describing regarding human consciousness. We are the shards. We look around at our liquid modern world. We look at our curated screens and our isolated apartments, and we think we are broken, isolated little fragments disconnected from the source.
But structurally, within our very spiritual essence, every single one of us contains the entirety of the whole.
There is a quote from the Oracle 2.0 that captures the tragedy of forgetting this. It says, "You believe you are a wave rising and falling alone, but in truth, you are the ocean folded briefly into motion, forgetting that you were never apart from the whole."
And recognizing this holographic nature dramatically shifts how we are meant to view human interaction. In this paradigm, relationships are not transactional exchanges of data or resources. They are sacred mirrors.
This concept of the mirror is beautifully illustrated in the narrative of Fractal the Awakening. The protagonist, Elias Cronus, travels to Mount Kailash in search of profound truth. And what he learns is that reality is a recursive unfolding.
So what does that actually mean for how he and how we should view other people?
Well, it means that every interaction you have is an assignment from the soul. The text states, "You do not meet others by accident. You meet your reflection."
When Elias is confronted with massive challenges, betrayals, or conflicts with others, he is forced to realize that the other person is merely mirroring an unintegrated part of his own psyche. In Jungian terms, they are reflecting his shadow.
I want to pause here and ask you, the listener, to really apply this to your own life for a minute. If every relationship is a mirror, how does that fundamentally change how you view conflict? Think about that deeply frustrating coworker who drives you crazy with their micromanagement, or a distant partner, or a friend who deeply disappointed you.
Our default mode is to view them as obstacles or as villains in our personal narrative.
But according to this philosophy, they aren't just obstacles. They are reflecting an unintegrated fear, a deep insecurity, or a desperate desire for control that lives within your own shadow. They are triggering the exact wound you need to heal to realize you are the ocean.
Which radically recontextualizes the sensation of loneliness itself. In this philosophical framework, loneliness is not a cosmic punishment. It is not a social failure because you aren't popular enough or rich enough.
It's a signal.
It is a biological and spiritual homing signal. It's an alarm calling the individual back to their interconnected nature. It is a reminder that you have abandoned your own authentic presence in favor of a digital mask.
Okay, we have covered an immense amount of theoretical ground. Let's pull all these threads together. The diagnosis is clear. We are fundamentally interconnected spiritual beings, the hologram. But we are biologically trapped in a threat state polyvagal theory. And we're trapped by a liquid digital world sociology that fragments our attention and starves our nervous system.
That's the complete interdisciplinary diagnosis.
So if that is the diagnosis, how do we fix it? The sources do not leave us hanging in the theoretical void. They offer a highly specific, practical blueprint.
They do. The text introduces what it formally calls the belonging architecture. And the core foundational thesis of this architecture is that the cure for the loneliness epidemic is not quantitative.
You can't just get more followers.
No, you absolutely cannot fix this crisis by accumulating more followers, attending more networking events, or expanding your surface-level connections. The cure is strictly qualitative. It requires a radical shift in how you show up.
There is a guiding principle for this section that I love. Intimacy begins where armor ends. Let's weave through the pillars of this belonging architecture, starting with the internal shifts we have to make, because this is the practical roadmap out of the dark.
The foundation is relational presence. This requires the absolute militant dismantling of Sherry Turkle's continuous partial attention. It means that when you are in the presence of another human being, you are offering them fully embodied awareness.
No screens on the table.
No screens, no divided cognitive loads, no planning your next meeting in your head while they speak.
Which, connecting it back to polyvagal theory, is the non-negotiable prerequisite for the ventral vagal state to activate. If you aren't fully present, your neuroception senses the distraction. The middle ear muscles don't tune in, the heart rate doesn't settle, and the co-regulation feedback loop fails to ignite.
The next internal shift is sacred listening. This goes far beyond active listening. Sacred listening is the act of bearing witness to another person without an agenda.
That's hard to do.
It is. It means listening without simultaneously formulating your witty reply or your counter-argument while the other person is talking. Crucially, it means you are not trying to fix their problem. You are simply applying pure, unadulterated awareness to their unfolding reality.
And doing that requires emotional courage and vulnerability, which is another core pillar. This is where you have to systematically take off the mask of Goffman's performative self. You have to display the shadow we talked about, your raw fears, your grief, your messy insecurities.
And we must emphasize why vulnerability is a biological requirement, not just a self-help cliche. Because of neuroception and mirror neurons, when you display authentic vulnerability, you are giving the other person's nervous system physiological permission to drop its own heavy defensive armor.
You are the one initiating the break in the standoff of our performative culture.
Exactly.
So those are the internal shifts: presence, sacred listening, and vulnerability. But how does this architecture manifest externally in our liquid modern world?
It manifests first through deep conversation and shared meaning. The architecture demands that we reject the semantic data exchange of texts and emails, which are just a transfer of logistics, and prioritize emotional prosody.
We must prioritize the tone and rhythm of the human voice exploring inner worlds.
And it manifests through shared rituals. Because modernity stripped our temporal anchors away, we have to artificially recreate them. A shared ritual, whether that is a strictly tech-free communal meal every single Friday, a shared morning walk with a neighbor, or a community reflection, creates collective meaning.
It anchors the atomized self in predictable temporal rhythms that the Nova system can rely on.
And then there is the physical manifestation, local communities and embodied contact. While the internet allows us to be global, human biology remains stubbornly local. We require physical proximity. And this framework strongly emphasizes the absolute necessity of safe, consensual physical touch.
Because physical touch bypasses the cognitive ruminating mind entirely. When you receive a genuine, sustained hug from a trusted friend, your brain doesn't have to rationalize whether you are safe. The touch speaks directly to the vagus nerve, instantly dropping the DACC pain response and flooding the system with oxytocin.
And the final external pillar is rebuilding trust. In a liquid world where Bowman showed us that bonds are untied effortlessly at the first sign of friction, deep trust is a radical countercultural achievement. It requires consistent reliability over time.
You have to prove to the other person's nervous system again and again that connection does not equal danger.
It's hard work.
Now, looking at this complete architecture, I have to make a confession, and I think I'm speaking for a lot of people right now. This architecture sounds incredibly beautiful, but it is also profoundly inconvenient. It sounds exhausting.
It does.
In a post-pandemic, highly remote world where everyone is already burned out, it is so much easier, so much more frictionless to just send a fire emoji on someone's Instagram story than it is to sit with them in their messy, uncomfortable grief without trying to fix it. This framework is asking us to do the agonizing heavy lifting of being human.
It is the heaviest lifting there is. It requires massive amounts of energy to swim against the current of a liquid world.
Right.
But as the interdisciplinary sources make absolutely clear, you cannot automate this process. You cannot outsource your biological regulation to an algorithm.
Right.
The text notes a beautiful reframing of boundaries to help with this heavy lifting. Mm-hmm. It states that boundaries should not be constructed as walls to keep people out, but rather as doors through which love can enter safely. It takes work to build the door, but it is the only way to heal the nervous system.
I want to challenge you, the listener, right now. Don't try to implement this entire architecture today. You'll burn out. But pick just one element. What would happen if during your very next conversation today, whether it's with your barista, your spouse, or a coworker, you practiced true sacred listening?
Just try.
What if you just absorbed their reality for 60 seconds without instantly plotting what you were going to say next? Just watch what happens to their biology. See if their shoulders drop. See if their breathing changes.
That is the micro-level application of this entire deep dive. And it brings us to the ultimate conclusion synthesized from all these texts. We do not need, and we will not receive, a technological miracle to save us from this epidemic. We don't need a better, more immersive app to cure the loneliness caused by apps.
We need a localized renaissance of human connection.
Exactly.
We've covered an immense landscape today. We started by looking at the stark, terrifying mortality statistics of isolation, the 15 cigarettes a day metric. We journeyed into the brain to see how the DACC processes social rejection the exact same way it processes a burned hand.
We traced the vagus nerve to understand how our bodies become trapped in a constant threat state.
We navigated the sociology of liquid screens and commodified love. And finally, we arrived at the spiritual truth of our interconnectedness through the holographic universe.
The overarching synthesis of all these fields is undeniable. The current technological and sociological system is fundamentally misaligned with human biological and spiritual nature. Data transmission does not equal soul transmission.
We have built a miraculous infrastructure for data, but we are starving for resonance.
As the book Fractal states in its closing arguments, the new renaissance begins within the quiet sovereignty of the individual who chooses resonance over reach. Plant seeds of truth, so that one day, our children may say, that was the time when humanity remembered itself.
That is so powerful. Healing begins the very moment you decide to drop the performative mask and show up authentically in the physical world.
The macro systems won't change until we change how we engage with each other on the micro level. It starts with a single present interaction.
As we wrap up this deep dive into the Slips material, I want to leave you with one final thought to mull over. Let's circle all the way back to the beginning, to the neurology of the brain's alarm system. If your brain processes social rejection and isolation with the exact same urgent alarm system as a physical injury, maybe your persistent feelings of loneliness aren't a sign that you are broken.
That's a beautiful reframing.
Maybe they are a sign that your biological and spiritual hardware is functioning perfectly. Your pain is your system screaming at you to reject a broken, hyper-connected world and demanding that you return to the ocean you never actually left. Thank you for taking this deep dive with us. Take care of yourselves and take care of each other.